What's on your mind right now? The song you can't get out of your head? That breaking story? Or that conversation you just have to be a part of?
That's the brand new song from...
This is a breaking news report.
He shoots! He scores!
That's radio. Happening now. Connecting you to what matters most exactly when it's happening. From the airwaves to every device you stream on, radio is everywhere you are. It's local, live, and it's for you. Tag your favorite radio station tomorrow on social media and use hashtag National Radio Day to celebrate. That's hashtag National Radio Day.
Financial boost now that President Trump's one big beautiful bill is law. The Tax Foundation reports Americans will get an estimated average of $3,752 in tax cuts in 2026 due to reduced federal taxes next year. The bill locked in President Trump's tax cuts, plus added several deductions and tax credits.
So that source from the Tax Foundation there, looking like over almost $4,000 for the average home in tax cuts in 2026. Kind of hard to argue with that, unless you maybe were Steve Moore and maybe were trying to argue for more. That's a possibility as well. Steve Moore, back with us, distinguished fellow in economics at the Heritage Foundation and, of course, a Trump economic advisor. Check out his book, The Trump Economic Miracle and the Plan to Unleash Prosperity Again. Steve, are we unleashing prosperity again with the Trump administration?
Great to be with you, Annie. Well, I'm looking at the front page of the Wall Street Journal today. It talks about record earnings for American companies. So they're doing well, and that's good because you need healthy companies if you want healthy jobs and people employed. And also, you know, we've got, you know, 150 million Americans who are invested the retirement savings in the earnings of American companies. So that's really good. We've got record high consumer confidence, people feeling good about things, except for the fact that people don't like the high beef prices and coffee prices. But other than that, things are going well on that front. And that tax cut's going to be very meaningful to people. So, you know, that's a big, big reduction in their tax bill if you're a middle-class family.
You know, we're speaking with Steve Moore right now. The mentality, it's like the approach to money, especially air quotes, the government's money, which, of course, is the American people's money. There's just an entire foundational shift in how this administration looks at that dollar compared to the Biden administration. You've been up close to it. What's the main difference that you see?
Well, the Biden administration saw federal government spending and waste as a stimulus to the economy, which is crazy. It'd be wonderful if we could just have the government run up the credit card and we could all get rich. But of course, we all got poor trying that because inflation went so high that we were all, you know, the average family barely made, they had virtually no income gains in 4 years under Biden when you take into account inflation. And for many families, they were actually below water. So, you know, you can't just keep hiring people and spending money that you don't have and think that you're going to be a prosperous economy. So Trump has come in and he's doing exactly the opposite. He's starting to shrink the size of government finally. And I, by the way, there was on Friday, there was a headline in Reuters that I just verified the numbers that Trump has reduced the federal workforce, people working in Washington, D.C., by 300,000 by the end of this year. That's good. We want fewer people working for government, and we want more people working in the productive private sector of our economy.
We're speaking with Steve Moore, Trump economic advisor, distinguished fellow in economics at Heritage Foundation as well. Do you feel as though there is a lot more work to do on the tax code that is workable in this administration with Donald Trump and the Republican majority?
Well, I'm, as you know, a big advocate of a very, very simplified flat tax where you get rid of all the deductions, you get rid of all the loopholes, you get rid of all the special interest provisions that lobbyists have carved out from themselves. And you just have a simple 18% tax rate that everybody pays, and you just get a deduction for yourself and for your kids. And that would be, you know, we could reduce the size of the IRS by 80%. That way we could reduce the number of pages in the, you know, the tax code is like 50,000 pages long. Nobody understands it. So there's, I hate to say it, Annie, but there's still a lot of work to do to simplify the tax code. But we've done some, you know, but for example, today only 10% of Americans itemize their deductions. So that's a big simplification. You don't have to keep all these records now. You can just check the box, take the standard deduction, and you don't have to worry about, you know, how much did I give to charity? How much did I give for this, that, the other thing? So simplification is very important.
You know, one of the topics that I hear talked about a lot right now, thanks to Governor Ron DeSantis, maybe is leading the conversation on this in Florida, but it's about property tax. And now I live in the state of Illinois, as you and I have discussed before, and property taxes are outrageous here. And, you know, Governor DeSantis is saying, like, why should you have to rent your home from the government forever if you've paid for it, if you own it? What are your thoughts on property tax and the way it fits into our current tax system?
Well, you know, the thing is that in Florida, they don't have an income tax. So they you know, get a lot of their money from sales taxes and property taxes, which is a better way to do it because the income tax is the most evil of all taxes. But the, you know, you get your revenue from somewhere. So I'd certainly be in favor of cutting property tax. I live in Maryland, which is a very high tax state. So we have a high income and a high property tax, and that just is a killer. I'm paying, you know, I'm upper middle income. I'm not rich. I'm trying to get rich, but I'm not rich yet. But my wife and I pay almost half of our income in taxes.
Yeah.
That's just outrageous. In America, half of your income goes to the government?
Yeah. It's completely not America first. It's not Americans first. I go back to my right. conversation about point about Donald Trump shifting the mentality in the United States of America. Mm-hmm. It's like, I always think of my parents' generation, the boomer generation, coming out of course, the greatest generation. Like, there's this great pride in work and blue-collar work and making things. And you know, it didn't have to be the wealthiest person on the block to go to work and be very proud of the home you could provide for your family. And now right. we relish the opportunity to, like, how much are we going to get from our government? And I feel right. like Trump's really changing that. Do you see that happening with trying to bring business back and fire up businesses here on the home front?
Yeah, and I want to make sure people understand that a person can only have a job in government, get a paycheck from government, if there's a private sector worker supporting them. Right? So, you know, the problem is we now have 3 million people working for the United States government, and more than that, if you include our military. And I'm not trying to disparage anybody in the military. I think they're great heroes, but the fact is that you can't. That means you've got to have what. 10 million people working to support those 3 million paying their salaries and so on. So the more we can reduce the size of the federal workforce, and I think everybody outside of Washington or D.C. agrees we can drain the swamp, we lower the burden on working class Americans. And so that's a good thing. I mean, look, Trump is also the other big story is that Trump is actually getting rid of whole government agencies like the USAID, the Foreign Aid Establishment, gone. He's gotten rid of Corporation for Public Broadcasting. He's gotten rid of a bunch of these international aid organizations that we don't need. He's gotten rid of a lot of the wind and solar, green energy, corporate welfare grants. I mean, I could go on and on. So this is a sea change. I've been in Washington for 35 years. I've never seen this, where you actually we're really good at creating new agencies, but we've never been very good at getting rid of them until Trump came along.
Yeah, it's been such a 180 degree whiplash change from where we were even a year ago when President Biden was there and Kamala Harris was working to win the presidency. I know you've been a huge part of that, and we're always grateful that you spend your time with us on Monday afternoons, Steve Moore. Thanks for being here again.
Thank you. We're off to a good start. It's only been 6 months, and so you know, when I saw the president, I said, slow down, Mr. President. We can't keep up with you. You're going too fast here.
Yeah.
But he knows he's only got, you know, 4 years. You know, he cannot run for re-election. So he's going to pack in about 10 years worth of work in 4 years.
Yeah. And he seems to be off to a great start, certainly with your help and others. Thank you so much, Steve. We appreciate you.
Thank you, Annie.
Take care.
Have a great day.
You as well. Bye-bye. Oh, man, the property tax story in with Ron DeSantis in Florida, I'm looking at him going, why are you so awesome? Why is J.B. Pritzker so awful?
I'm just going to put this out there.
Okay.
If Ron DeSantis ran for governor of Illinois, I'd vote for him.
I'd vote for him twice.
Would you?
If I could figure out how the Democrats do it, yeah.
I would too. I would vote for that man over J.B. Pritzker.
Just, you don't even have to think about it?
After what he said about property taxes?
Yeah.
Actually, even if J.B. Pritzker said that about property taxes, I'd be like, oh, well, hello there.
Yeah. I was reading through some articles leading into the conversation with Steve Moore, and one of them was about Rhode Island. I think another one was about Maryland. But there are all these things that these heavy, heavy blue states are doing in response to the Big Beautiful Bill to be like, we're really going to stick it to the millionaires. And I'm like, do you have any left? And if
it's
you do,
so dumb.
Why? Like, why are we, you know, in the state of Illinois, one of the biggest things that Republicans are up against outside of corruption with the supermajority of Democrats, with J.B. Pritzker, with the Chicago machine. All of that, obviously, it would be a more fair fight if that stuff couldn't thrive in the state of Illinois. But the policies are so punitive that smart people who are also at the same time portable just leave. Now, I don't feel portable. I want to build a home. I'm going to build a home in Illinois. And the majority of you are going, Andy, that's the dumbest thing I ever heard. I thought you were a smart person. Well, here's the deal. It's a price to pay to be by my family, to raise my kids by my family. It's where home is. That's all important to me. And it's more important to me to invest in that in my future, in my family's future, and say I'm going to fight like hell to try to get some common sense back to the state of Illinois. It's just a priority that supersedes the absolute cesspool of politics that exists in the state. And I understand people who can't understand that. I understand if you've, like, the roots in my family and in my husband's family, like two separate families that came together when we got married, the roots here are so incredibly deep. And I can't, and my husband, we are in lockstep on this, we can't imagine ripping those roots up to go somewhere else so we could pay less taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And if that doesn't make sense, if you're like, Annie, you could just move across the river, I don't want to do that. And if I don't want to do that, and I have good reasons why, I would hope that that would be enough. But it goes along with saying, I'm going to stay here and I'm going to fight for this. I'm going to fight even if it seems useless. Did anybody think that Donald Trump would be elected for his second term in 2024? After, like, you know, on January 7th of 2021? Did anybody be like, if somebody would have told you on January 7th, guys, well, let me tell you what's about to happen here. It's like the parable. It's like the dream that Joseph has in the Bible, where it's like, we're going to have 7 years of famine, but it's going to be lit for a little bit. Just save up and store up and you'll be fine. If I would have had a dream, if I would have been able to know, I would have enjoyed the 4 years of Biden so much more, knowing like, I know how this ends. But we couldn't enjoy them. We didn't know how it ended. And it actually seemed impossible that Donald Trump could be reelected again. As you know, I was a huge supporter of Ron DeSantis to be the president, specifically before Donald Trump officially announced that he was going to run again. And I wanted Ron DeSantis. I still would love for Ron DeSantis to be the president of the United States. I would enjoy that greatly. But when Donald Trump decided to run, I've had people tell me, like, Annie, How could you have gone against Donald Trump? Here's the deal. I didn't think he could get elected. The Democrats would obviously do everything in their power to stop him from being able to find the Oval Office again. And, you know, I don't think there's any scientific evidence from. Was it Crook? Was it Crooks? Was that his name? Mm-hmm. That actually shot him? We know nothing about him. How can we know nothing about him? Was that part of some conspiracy to keep him from the Oval Office? We don't know that. But we don't know anything. So everything is possible. Somebody please provide us some information so we can understand what's going on here. I was so terrified that a Kamala Harris or Joe Biden when he was... Can you remember just for a second that Joe Biden was running for re-election?
Yeah.
Look where you are right now. Look where Joe Biden is right now. He was running for re-election until mid-July.
A little over a year ago.
Yes. That's how cocky the Democrat Party was. How comfortable they were in whatever ruse that they were running, that they could actually put this guy out there. Nobody would stand up and expose him, except for that one representative who was like, nobody's going to challenge this guy. He's senile. I guess I'll run. I can't remember his name.
Yeah, from Minnesota. I can't remember his name either.
It wasn't Tim Walz.
Dean Phillips.
Dean Phillips. Dean, my man.
That's it.
I got respect for that guy. He stood up and threw his name out there when nobody else would do it. The story arc of Donald Trump is in the top 10 greatest political stories in the history of the world. Fight me.
I can't. It's hard to, it would be hard, even if you're a Democrat, to deny that.
Sure. just ask how much it hurts them. Yeah. Right now, especially the sane ones, especially the sane Democrats. And we all know sane Democrats. Yes, I said it. I have lots of friends who are Democrats and they're not lunatics. Those people out there who were watching their Democrat party act an absolute fool for so incredibly long. And they're like, you have to stop this. We are going to create a manifest a Donald Trump second term. And then they did. And here we are. All right. The YouTube poll for today, and I failed because I should have added a third option. We've discussed this off air. The YouTube poll is, does it matter if Ukraine President Zelensky wears a suit? Yes or no? But I guess if I worded it that way, the last option I would have added in there is I don't care. But I don't care is actually, in this instance, no, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Right?
I think so.
Does it matter if Ukraine President Zelensky wears a suit? Yes or no? He's wearing a fancy jacket, coat with a collar, and a shirt with a collar. I think if you were betting suit or no suit, I think this counts as a suit.
Yeah. I mean, it's got a collar. It's got buttons. It's a jacket.
Well, it's a...
It doesn't have a tie, though. So is that a suit? Yeah, I think it is. I just answered my own question.
Anything else?
No, I'm good.
Go vote in the poll and tell us, does it matter if Ukraine President Zelensky wears a suit? Yes or no? It's so close. You guys are super divided over this issue. Weigh in. Let us know what you think. We'll get you the results with Ethan later on in the show. Scooter said, if athleisure is acceptable attire for conservative influencers, it's suitable for a meeting at the White House. Such sound logic, Scoot. We'll be right back.
What's on your mind right now? The song you can't get out of your head? That breaking story? Or that conversation you just have to be a part of?
That's the brand new song from...
This is a breaking news report.
He shoots! He scores!
That's radio. Happening now. Connecting you to what matters most exactly when it's happening. From the airwaves to every device you stream on, radio is everywhere you are. It's local, live, and it's for you. Tag your favorite radio station tomorrow on social media and use hashtag National Radio Day to celebrate. That's hashtag National Radio Day.
Senator Eric Schmidt's coming up here in a little bit. Gosh, I love the way he approaches his job. He might be my favorite politician in Washington, D.C.
I would really like to add something to this show, but I'm agreeing with you too much today. Like when you say, well, is Donald Trump the most consequential, top 10 most amazing political comeback ever? I'm supposed to say, no, that's stupid. But I agree.
Is this how you approach your job?
Kind of.
Your reflex is just to disagree with me?
I think so.
And you're thinking things through enough to realize I was right?
Well, I've already come to my independent conclusions. And then when you say them, I'm like, crap. Oh, she's just speaking to the choir now, preaching to the choir. I'm the choir.
Tell me something I'm wrong on.
I don't think you're giving DeSantis enough credit for the property tax thing.
I brought it up.
Yeah, but it deserves another hour. I think it's something that we get DeSantis on.
I can go home. Okay.
We get Christina Pershaw on.
Let's go.
We get the whole cabinet in
Florida.
I'll
take the 2 o'clock hour off.
Okay.
You just whip up a Ron DeSantis interview.
Okay.
And I will tune in.
Can we get, this is probably asking a little bit too much, can we get the governor of every red state on the phone at the same time?
One time?
Yeah.
Like a quadruple teen lateral?
I don't know what you'd call it. There's probably political speak for it, and that's where you come in, because you know all that stuff. But but can you get all of them on the phone at the same time, just so that DeSantis can kind of walk through the plan?
Yes, we'll do it in the 3 o'clock hour.
Wait a minute. I don't agree with that.
Here's a report coming out of Fox News from earlier in the day regarding the possibilities of what might transpire.
What land swaps there might be. We wanted to go to the touch screen here and kind of lay it all out for you where we are and how things might move. So first of all, the eastern part of Ukraine and Crimea. Of course, Crimea has been totally occupied since 2014 by Russia. But the areas that we're talking about here are Luhansk, Donetsk, Zaporizhia, and the Kherson area. And in those areas, Luhansk is 99.5% occupied by Russia. Donetsk, which is really the focus of all of the talk in the last few days, only about 76%, 73% in Zaporizhia, 70% in Kherson. So let's zoom in now on the area of Donetsk that we're talking about here. And this is the part that's occupied here by Russia. This part is still occupied by Ukraine. And that's the part that Vladimir Putin has got his sights set on, and he wants to gain in any kind of a peace deal here. Now, what's interesting is that Ukraine is saying, well, wait a second, you don't occupy that territory, so why would we ever give it away? And according to a poll that was done recently in Kyiv, 78% of Ukrainians say, we're not giving Russia any territory that they don't already control. But here's the reason why that is so important. So you have here three cities, Sloviansk, Kramatorsk, and Konstantinivka. These are major population centers. There's still about 300,000 people living here. But very importantly is that these two cities of Sloviansk and Kramatorsk, those were headquarters for the military since 2014 when Russia moved into this area. So there's a heavy defense line. We talk about this being the fortress wall along here. And this is what Russia has been trying to penetrate and can't, because the Ukrainian forces are so embedded in here that the Russians just can't get through. But if those properties went to Russia in any kind of a peace agreement, here is the concern. That this area here is pretty much flat farmland going all the way into the center part of Ukraine.
So there's a lot of conversation surrounding what land could go where and how it would materialize. But I think it's likely that there will be some sort of land concessions that are made. And I guess that's what the conversation right now with Zelensky and these European leaders in the White House is going to come down to. What are you going to have to do, President Zelensky? You're going to have to make some concessions, but maybe it's not that. And there can be a lot of American, along with European Union pressure, put on Putin to say, this is what they're willing to give. And if you're not going to play ball, the whole situation, the status quo here is going to change on what you're going to have to fight up against. We'll find out probably by the end of the day what kind of success has materialized in the meetings that are taking place at the White House, and we will bring you anything that breaks during the show as it happens. We got to take a quick break because we have Senator Eric Schmidt coming on with us here in just a minute. The last line of defense, how to beat the left in court. Well, you know this because you've been following the story, but Senator Eric Schmidt wrote the book on that. No, I mean, he literally wrote the book on that. We're going to talk to him about that. And I'm going to ask him, is Donald Trump the right guy to mediate peace between Russia and Ukraine? Senator Eric Schmidt on the Annie Fry Show next.
What's on your mind right now? The song you can't get out of your head? That breaking story? Or that conversation you just have to be a part of?
That's the brand new song from...
This is a breaking news report.
He shoots! He scores!
That's radio. Happening now. Connecting you to what matters most exactly when it's happening. From the airwaves to every device you stream on, radio is everywhere you are. It's local, live, and it's for you. Tag your favorite radio station tomorrow on social media and use hashtag National Radio Day to celebrate. That's hashtag National Radio Day.
President Trump is a peacemaker, and he is mediating a brutal meat grinder war to a truce. And that's going to take some time, and both sides are going to have to give, and he's going to have to see how far both sides are willing to go. And you know, there is nobody that is better positioned and can bring the parties to the table than Donald Trump. And I think he should be given the support of really all these elected politicians that are doing nothing to help Ukraine settle this war, to help with the rebuilding of Ukraine.
So you have Matt Whitaker there, the U.S. ambassador to NATO, talking about how President Trump is a peacemaker mediating a brutal meat grinder war to a truce. And that's what we're all watching is in Washington, D.C. today at the White House. Zelensky and the European Union leaders come together to seek peace. Let's get our guest on here. Welcome back to the show, Senator Eric Schmidt. We've got a lot to talk to you about here in an amount of time. We're going to breeze through it. But I wanted to give you the opportunity to talk about President Trump, what he's doing right now to try to seek peace between Russia and Ukraine.
Yeah, I'm just grateful we have a president that's very focused on that, right? I mean, we saw 4 years of not really having a plan other than just sending taxpayer dollars over to Ukraine without a plan and a blank check. President Trump is trying to bring these parties together. He's the only person literally in the world who can do that. He met with Putin. He's meeting with Zelensky today with the hope that this leads to a trilateral, I think, meeting that President Trump can help broker an end to the war. It's been a bloodbath. Matt Whitaker's right. It's a meat grinder. It's a war of attrition at this point. Over a million people have died. And so I think he's trying to bring resolution to it. And I applaud him for it.
Senator Schmidt speaking with us right now. Do you feel as though like there's so much media noise right now because we're kind of in this purgatory between President Trump has managed to get Vladimir Putin on American soil to have a conversation with him. Now he's got Zelensky here in D.C. There's a lot of fodder for the media types out there to lob against Donald Trump with all the usual types of criticisms. When you're in your position as an attorney general, when you were in the state of Missouri, or if you're as a senator, or if you're the president of the United States, is that just all outside noise? Does it get into the conversations at all?
Well, I think there are some things that the conversation's more appropriate kind of in real time. But then there are some things like international diplomacy that take a little bit more time. And I think that with a 24-hour news cycle, like on cable TV, I mean, you're going to have a panel. They're going to talk about this. They're going to talk about that. I think there's a kind of a risk when you're talking about dealing with countries who are at war, who have their own national interests, their own historical context, all this. You want to give it a little bit of air, a little bit of room to breathe. I do find it fascinating, though. I was on Fox News Sunday yesterday and said something similar, which is the people who are being critical of this, though, honestly, are the people who've been wrong about so many things for so long. They don't have any solutions. Like ask, Democrat Senator Chris Murphy, who's criticizing President Trump, what's your solution? Is the solution that this just goes on forever? Is the solution that we wouldn't meet with Putin or we wouldn't, try to bring this thing together? That's the wrong course. We need to actually meet with people who, wouldn't be somebody that you necessarily want to marry your daughter, but happen to be leading a country and you're trying to broker a peace. That's diplomacy. It's hard and it doesn't happen overnight. And I think that's the process the president's engaged in right now.
Yeah, we're not engaging in a moral transformation of Vladimir Putin. We want him to stop killing Ukrainians and capturing their children and all of the horrendous things that Vladimir Putin has been engaged in. It's, I think, measuring an achievable goal here. When I watch, I did see you on the Sunday shows, and I was thinking to myself, some of these people want Donald Trump to fail because they're more invested in his failure than they are in actual world peace.
Yeah, or they kind of want some proxy war to go on forever. And that's just, you look at the Ukrainians, even how they view this, the polling in 2 years has flipped dramatically. You've got 70% of Ukrainians now that want to get to a negotiated peace. And so, again, the only person on the planet who can do that's President Trump. I think we all, whether you're Republican or a Democrat, should applaud him for going down this road because he doesn't have to. I mean, look, if the United States is involved with this, our daily lives sort of go on. He's trying to be, he's already struck a number of deals, whether it's Pakistan and India or Azerbaijan and Armenia. He's really trying on the world stage to help bring about peace. And this is a tough nut to crack, but he's given it a shot.
Senator Eric Schmidt speaking with us right now. Last question on the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Secretary Marco Rubio just said this weekend on the Sunday shows, he said, there's the difference between a negotiated peace and a surrender. We're not going to get a surrender here from either of these two parties, which means there are going to be concessions made by both sides. And Donald Trump has repeatedly said, President Trump said, this is up to them to decide how this ends. They are the ones who have to make a deal. But of course, here on the home front, it's going to, whatever happens, those concessions are going to be used as political capital against Donald Trump. Do you have an expectation as to what kind of concessions that you would like to see and those that you really think would not be good for future peace and for the United States' partnership there?
Well, I think, there's going to be this comes down to territory, right? And that's going to be up to the Ukrainians and the Russians to figure out what that looks like. I mean, I think the idea that somehow Crimea, which was, the Russians took without a shot being fired when Barack Obama was in office in 2014, that somehow is going to end up back in Ukrainian hands is a fantasy. That's not going to happen. So you're dealing with sort of where they're at right now and what that looks like. I don't think there's any appetite for American troops to be part of any kind of like peacekeeping. I don't think that's on the table. But Europeans need to step up in a much more meaningful way, not just for their national defense, but the role that they can play in helping bring this war to an end, too. And I think that's one of the good things why they're in Washington today in meeting also. I think, again, you saw this stupid narrative that Marco Rubio sort of called out, Secretary Rubio called out, like somehow this was to prevent Zelensky from being bullied. No, this is actually what leadership is. You bring parties of maybe somewhat divergent interests together and find a resolution. And that's what he's doing.
Yeah. And President Trump seems to do it over and over and over again. I think back to that press conference where the reporter's like, why do you think you can do this? And he says, that's what I do. It was really that simple. We're speaking with Senator Eric Schmidt. I want to talk to you about your book that is out right now, The Last Line of Defense, How to Beat the Left in Court, because while this might be kind of a storytelling of your experience as the attorney general for the state of Missouri, it's still very, all of this is very relevant today. You have fought the far overreaching left in court and won again and again and again. And I tie it into what the media part of the conversation we're having right now. The left uses, it seems like they go on these wild pursuits of these crazy policies. You have to be crazy enough to take them to court. And then when you do, you win, Senator Eric Schmidt. They need the media to go along to make the narrative so much that you are supposed to be afraid to do that, to take it to court and to win on behalf of the American people. You were unafraid and you won again and again. Talk to me about The Last Line of Defense, How to Beat the Left in Court, this book. What are people going to get?
Yeah, I think for your audience in particular, I mean, I'm, you know, native St. Louisan and was on your show as this was unfolding in real time when I was Missouri's attorney general. And I just thought this story is a very important story to tell. This was a crazy time. This was the time of lockdowns and mandatory COVID vaccines and masking five-year-olds and a vast censorship enterprise. And what I found was that what people are looking for most is authentic leadership. They want somebody who's going to stand up and fight for them. And that was my experience. And so there's a playbook that can be drawn from that, which is why, you know, I'll be doing a lot of shows talking about this, but I really think for your audience, and by the way, Last Line of Defense, How to Beat the Left of Court, you can go on Amazon right now on your phone and order it. And I think your audience is going to love it because this is a national story that happened right here in Missouri. And there's a lot of cool anecdotes about taking Fauci's deposition, taking the FBI agent that was trying to pre-bunk the Hunter Biden laptop story. There's a great story in there during the bicentennial 4 years ago in Jefferson City and the difference between masking policies. I think the audience will love it because it's about Missouri. But it's about that, I think, willingness to fight your way into the arena, push back and win. And we see now what the left is doing to try to thwart the will of the people, President Trump's agenda. And there's some lessons learned from those fights here in Missouri that can be drawn for the fights ahead.
It's so true. And I remember feeling a little bit like we were on ground zero here in St. Louis because of what you were willing to do as the attorney general here. It felt very hopeless for people who felt like, I think that I'm a common sense person. Like, this stuff to me feels like it's absolutely crazy.
Annie, what's interesting is, so I've never written a book before, but the process of this really, in the first couple chapters, basically that's the point. I said, let's get in the DeLorean and go back in time now to what it was really like in that moment. And if you remember, you had Sam Page and you had all these people shutting down restaurants. You had school administrators, even though COVID didn't affect kids, no kids were dying of COVID, but yet it was hard to find people who were, you know, in public who were elected willing to stand up and say, you know what? We're not going to allow you to mask five-year-olds anymore. Somebody shouldn't lose their job that they've had for 20 years as they provide for their family because they make the decision not to take the COVID shot. People should be able to make that decision. So in this book, we outlined, for example, Missouri brought that case against the vaccine mandates. We took it to the Supreme Court and we won. Missouri brought the student loan debt forgiveness case that got ultimately Biden got struck down at the Supreme Court because Missouri had this little known loan servicing agency called Mohila. I remember Mohila well because I got monthly bills or invoices for them for my student loans. So we took, and then of course, probably the most infamous case is the Missouri versus Biden case where we uncovered this censorship enterprise that was before Elon Musk had bought Twitter and before these congressional investigations. So ground zero, protecting people's liberties and fighting back of the Biden administration happened right here in Missouri. And I'm grateful to be able to tell this story about what it takes to push back and win.
Well, the book is The Last Line of Defense, How to Beat the Left in Court, Senator Eric Schmidt's book. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it where books are available. One quote here from the book that I want you to comment on a little bit. We were on the front line of freedom and the last line of defense until Trump could return. The thought of what we were doing, watching you do here in the state of Missouri on behalf of people in all other states, including Illinois myself. I just looked it up. It was May of 2023 when Governor Pritzker lifted the emergency mandate in the state of Illinois, which is outrageous. But you say until Trump could return. How do you view what you were working totally against the grain in Missouri how does that feed into Donald Trump's back in 2025?
Yeah, again, if you go back in time, think about this. President Trump was out of power. His allies were out of power. It kind of fell to some relatively unknown figures, and I would put myself in that class, who were going to push back. And in looking back on it now, on the other side of the fever dream, which is what it felt like, right? I think it's easy now to not remember. There was police tape around playgrounds. They were censoring speech.
Outdoors.
You know, kid. By the way, we opened up a parent portal in Missouri where parents could reach out to us. There were kids who refused to wear masks, even though they didn't have to wear masks, who were put on stages in the middle of gyms, isolated from their classmates to humiliate them. Like, this is the world that we were living in. And we document that in the book. But I think the way I view it now more historically is that in this wild, crazy time that was defined by social unrest, lockdowns, and the Biden administration's overreach, we kind of held the line for the freedoms we hold most dear until the cavalry could come. And the cavalry arrived in November 2024 when President Trump was brought, you know, was elected by the popular vote, even though they were trying to bury him, his family, bankrupt his family, put him in jail for the rest of his life. And so now that we're on the other side of it, what are the lessons that can be learned? And that's what The Last Line of Defense is all about. That's what the book's about.
That's right. It is a playbook, a legal playbook, a call to arms. And the MAGA conservative is going to be interested in this. But I think a lot of people who maybe have woken up to how outrageous those times were and are watching Donald Trump succeed right now, if they want to take a peek back through your eyes on what was going on, how you saw it from a legal standpoint, from a patriot standpoint, The Last Line of Defense, How to Beat the Left in Court. Folks need to get this book. I can't wait to read it. I lived it there.
You'll really like it, because honestly, I was coming on your show when we would file some new lawsuit against, and we just kind of were methodically, and at the time they could have seemed like battles here or there.
Yeah.
But in the aggregate now, this really was the defense of our freedoms. And to this day, Annie, I'll still, when I'm at Schnucks, somebody will come up to me, typically a mom will come up to me and say, you know what, thanks for standing up for our kids when not a lot of people were willing to do that.
So
and
true.
So, yep, that's what it's about.
That's why we play Can't Stop by the Red Hot Chili Peppers when Eric Schmidt is on the show, because we said, please don't stop. You're doing such a great job. We'll be checking out the book. Thank you so much, Senator, for coming on the show. It's always a pleasure to have you.
Thanks, Annie.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I can't wait to read this book. This is one that I think is going to be able to just, like, you can't put it down, because when you've lived it, when you've experienced it, but now you get to get a peek behind the curtain as to how they were fighting it. People like Attorney General Eric Schmidt, when he was in the state of Missouri, this was like the first affirmation that the things that I was thinking, that you were thinking, like, this is crazy, right? What are they doing? You can't do that in America. That's nuts. And Senator Eric Schmidt is, or excuse me, then Attorney General Eric Schmidt is like, no, you can't do that. That's nuts. And also illegal. We're going to fight it. And he wins. And it makes you go, I don't think I'm crazy. It's on Audible. I'm going to listen to the audiobook. I want you to go get it. The Last Line of Defense by Senator Eric Schmidt. Quick break. Let's get Ryan back in here. Was there some news?
They came out. I thought they were going to do a press conference, but it was just a photo op. So it was all the European leaders and President Trump.
So they're shifting from one meeting to another, maybe?
Right. Yeah,
right.
And Zelensky and all them together.
Everything happening in D.C. We've got it covering. We're covering it live for you right here on 97.1 FM Talk, St. Louis Conservative. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Annie Fry Show. We are watching right now from the White House, where the leaders have sat around a table to have a discussion. They are making it public. So we are going to tune in here in just a moment and listen. President Trump sitting center of the table with five people on each side of the table. We're going to bring it from the very beginning. Macron on his right, Maloney, I always get it wrong, on his left. Let's listen in, and this is from the top. President Trump speaking with European leaders and Zelensky.
Please, come on in. Do you guys want to take some questions or anything? Feel like it? Huh? Huh? Hi, Mark.
See you.
Yeah, hi. Good.
Good evening.
Well, thank you very much. It's a great honor to have you here. Special place. White House is special no matter where you're from. Represents so much, and it really is beautiful. And thank you for all of the wonderful things that took place today. We've had a very successful day thus far. And important discussions as we work to end the killing and stop the war in Ukraine. We're all working for the same goal. Very simple goal. We want to stop the killing, get this settled. I've just had the honor of being with President Zelensky and all of the discussions that we've had. We covered a lot of territory. And I spoke indirectly with President Putin today. We're going to call President Putin right after this meeting. I'm sure we're going to have a solid meeting, good meeting, maybe a great meeting. And we're going to try and work out a trilat after that and see if we can get it finished. Put this to sleep, because this is not since the Second World War has there been anything like this. So I'm honored to welcome NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte, who's a great gentleman, great, great political leader in Europe generally, but now he's the NATO Secretary General, and you're doing a fantastic job. Thank you very much, Mark. Prime Minister Starmer of the United Kingdom, our friend and my friend, and doing really well, and people like him a lot. We all like him. Everyone knows President Macron of France, who's been with me from the beginning, one of the first people I met as a foreign dignitary, and I liked him from day one. And I like him even more now. That's pretty good. That's unusual. That's a pretty unusual thing. Prime Minister Meloni of Italy, who's a really a great leader and an inspiration over there. She's served now, even though she's a very young person, she's served there for a long period of time relative to others. They don't last very long. You've lasted a long time. You're going to be there a long time. Chancellor Merz of Germany, who is a very strong person and a very strong leader and very highly respected in Germany. And he's my friend, and it's an honor to have him as my friend. Thank you very much. Very good. You look great with your tan. Where did you get that tan? I want to get a tan like that.
That's true.
President Stubb of Finland, and he's somebody that, where are we here? Where?
I'm right here.
Oh. You look better than I've ever seen you look. But you've done a great job, and we wanted to have you here because you're somebody that we all respect. And you've had a lot to do with the success, I think, and the potential success. And thank you very much for being here. We appreciate it. And the president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, who is somebody that we just made a big deal with. With all of those countries, I don't know. I think you might be more powerful than all these guys at this table. I don't know. But you, we had a great negotiation, and you're respected all over the world. So I want to thank you very much for being here. It's a great honor to have you. The Alaska Summit reinforced my belief that while difficult, peace is within reach, and I believe that in a very significant step, President Putin agreed that Russia would accept security guarantees for Ukraine, and this is one of the key points that we need to consider, and we're going to be considering that at the table also, like who will do what, essentially. I'm optimistic that collectively we can reach an agreement that would deter any future aggression against Ukraine, and I actually think there won't be. I think that's even largely overrated, but we're going to find out, and I think that the European nations are going to take a lot of the burden. We're going to help them, and we're going to make it very secure. We also need to discuss the possible exchanges of territory, taking into consideration the current line of contact. That means the war zone, the war lines that are pretty obvious, very sad, actually, to look at them. And negotiating positions. President Putin, you have President of Ukraine, who is you just met a little while ago, and we're going to try and get a three-party meeting, maybe as soon as we can. And I have a feeling you and President Putin are going to work something out. Ultimately, this is a decision that can only be made by President Zelensky and by
the people of Ukraine working also together in agreement with President Putin. And I just think that's very good things are going to come of it. So I hope we have a good meeting. And if we can have a good meeting, I'll set up a meeting with President Putin. And if you'd like, I'll go to that meeting. And not that I want to do that, but I will do that because we want to save a lot of people from dying. A lot of people are dying, and we got to save them. We got to save it. 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 people sometimes a week. All of us would obviously prefer an immediate ceasefire while we work on a lasting peace, and maybe something like that could happen. As of this moment, it's not happening, but President Zelensky and President Putin can talk a little bit more about that. You know, in the six or so wars that we stopped, we haven't had a ceasefire. And so I don't know that it's necessary. You can do it through the war, but it would be I like the ceasefire from another standpoint. You immediately stop the killing. But I believe a peace agreement at the end of all of this is something that's very attainable, and it can be done in the near future. With all of the wars that I got involved in, we only have this one left. Of course, as I walk out the door, there'll probably be a new one starting, and I'll get that stopped, too. But I thought this was going to be one of the easier ones. It's actually one of the most difficult and very complex. The next step would be for a trilateral meeting, and that will be worked out. And I just look forward to working and having a great result. We're going to spend a lot of time today talking about, and we're really honored you guys came over. I mean, these are the heads of major countries and respected all over Europe. And they speak for largely, I think I should say, but pretty much for the other countries of Europe. And we will come to a resolution today, I think, on almost everything, including probably the security. And that's pretty much the story. I'd like to say, Mr. President, would you like to say something? You have the media. If you want, you could come over and you could stand, you could use mine, or you could just turn around, whichever you feel comfortable with.
Thank you so much. I can speak without microphone. Thank you so much. I think that we had very good conversation with President Trump.
Very good.
And it really was the best one. Maybe the best one will be in the future. But it was really good. And we spoke about very sensitive points. The first one is security guarantees. And we are very happy with President that all the leaders are here, and the security in Ukraine depends on the United States and on you and on those leaders who are with us in our hearts. They have been on online before yesterday and etc. So a lot of countries on the side of Ukraine, our people, and all of us want to finish this war, stop Russia and stop this war. We spoke about it, and we will speak more about security guarantees. This is very important that the United States gives such strong signal and is ready for security guarantees. The second point, or maybe the first, humanitarian direction, very important to exchange all the prisoners, and I think that President will help, and I was very thankful to your wife again, Mr. President, for the letter about our abducted children, and I hope that really it can be a historic role for the people to bring kids back to the families and be happy.
And get their people families back, yeah.
Yes, this is so important, and I'm happy that we discussed it, this track with the President Trump, and I hope that we will find decisions. And then what is very important, that all the sensitive things, territorial, etc., we will discuss on the level of leaders during trilateral meeting, and President Trump will try to organize such meeting, and he said that he will come or not come. Ukraine will be happy if you
both want me there, I will be there. Yeah,
you know, thank you. And I think this is very important. Yes, so security guarantees, bringing kids back, and all our people, not only warriors, first of all warriors, and all the civilians, journalists, a lot of people in prison. So we need them back. And guarantees which will work for the years, we spoke about it, and I showed to President a lot of details on the battlefield, on the map. Thank you so much. Thank you for the map, by the way.
Good map.
It was great. Yeah. I'm thinking how to take it back.
We'll get you.
No. I think that we had constructive specific meeting. And I'm very thankful to all the leaders who are here, and you help a lot. And so we are happy that we have such big unity today. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. I think you'll see that President Putin really would like to do something also. I think when we set that up, when we do, I think it's going to be when, not if. I think you're going to see some very really positive moves. I know there's over 1,000 prisoners, and I know they're going to release them. Maybe they're going to release them very soon, like immediately, which I think is great. But we will, we're going to set that up today after this meeting. So very good and great remarks. I appreciate it. Mark, as head of NATO, maybe you could say a few words, please.
Yes, I will be very brief. I really want to thank you, President of the United States, dear Donald, for the fact that you, as I said before, broke the deadlock. Basically, with President Putin by starting that dialogue. And I think it was in February that you had the first phone call. And from there, we are now where we are today. And that is, I think, if we play this well, we could end this. And we have to end this. We have to stop the killing. We have to stop the destruction of Ukraine's infrastructure. It is a terrible war. So I'm really excited. And let's make the best out of today and make sure that from today onwards, we get this thing to an end as soon as possible. I really want to thank you for your leadership, what you are doing for Volodymyr, but of course also all the European colleagues. It is really crucial. And the fact that you have said, I'm willing to participate in the security guarantees is a big step. It's really a breakthrough, and it makes all the difference. So also thank you for that.
Well, NATO also has agreed from 2% to 5%, which is something that is a massive amount of money. And it's 2% that wasn't always paid to 5% that is paid. That's a big difference. And so we appreciate that. That was a great move. Thank you very much. Ursula, maybe on behalf of the Commission, you could say a couple of words.
Yes. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. And it's a very important moment. Indeed, we are here, Europeans, as friends and allies. We had a fantastic NATO summit. Together as the two largest and biggest economies in the world, we had the largest trade deal ever agreed. And now we are here to work together with you on a just and lasting peace for Ukraine. Stop the killing. This is really our common interest, stop the killing. And indeed, it's very good to hear that we're working on the security guarantees, Article 5 lies security guarantees, so important. But I want to thank you also that you mentioned the thousands of Ukrainian children that have been abducted. And as a mother and grandmother, every single child has to go back to its family. This should be one of our main priorities also in these negotiations, to make sure that the children come back to Ukraine, to their families.
Thank you. And we did. I was just thinking we're here for a different reason, but we just a couple of weeks ago made the largest trade deal in history. So that's a big thing. And congratulations. That's great. Thank you very much, Ursula. Mr. Chancellor from Germany, a very great leader.
Mr. President, dear Donald, many thanks for having us today. I think this is extremely helpful that we are meeting and hearing that the two of you are having such a good meeting today here in Washington. The next steps ahead are the more complicated ones now. The path is open. You opened it last Friday. But now the way is open for complicated negotiations. And to be honest, we all would like to see a ceasefire, the latest from the next meeting on. I can't imagine that the next meeting would take place without a ceasefire. So let's work on that, and let's try to put pressure on Russia, because the credibility of these efforts we are undertaking today are depending on at least a ceasefire from the beginning of the serious negotiations from next step on. So I would like to emphasize this aspect and would like to see a ceasefire from the next meeting, which should be a trilateral meeting wherever it takes place.
Well, we're going to let the president go over and talk to the president, and we'll see how that works out and if we can do that. I will say, and again I say it, in the six wars that I've settled, I haven't had a ceasefire. We just got into negotiations, and one of the wars was, as you know, in the Congo, was 31 years long. Another one that we settled last week with two great countries was 35 years going on, and we had no ceasefire. So if we can do the ceasefire, great. And if we don't do a ceasefire, because many other points were given to us, many, many points were given to us, great points. Please, Georgia, go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Donald, Mr. President, for hosting us today in this important meeting. And I think it is an important day, a new phase, after 3 years and a half that we didn't see any kind of sign from the Russian side that there was a willing for dialogue. So something is changing, something has changed, thanks to you. Thanks also to the stalling in the battlefield, which was achieved with the bravery of Ukrainians and with the unity that we all provided to Ukraine. And the reason why I mention it is that we also have to remind that if we want to reach peace and if we want to guarantee justice, we have to do it united. So that's why it's a very good day, the one we are in. You can obviously count on Italy as it was from the beginning. We are on the side of Ukraine, and we do absolutely support your efforts towards peace. We will talk about many important topics. The first one is security guarantees, how to be sure that it won't happen again, which is the precondition of every kind of peace. I'm happy that we will discuss about that. I'm happy that we will begin from a proposal, which is the, let's say, Article 5 model, which was Italian at the beginning. So we are always ready to bring our proposals for peace, for dialogue. It's something we have to build together to guarantee peace and to defend the security of our nation. So thank you, Mr. President, for hosting us.
Thank you very much. Emmanuel?
All right, we got to go to a break. That's what we got to do right now. They've gone around the table. Emmanuel Macron about to speak right now as well. I think there's maybe a few more people to talk, but I definitely wanted to listen to Meloni speak. If you haven't gotten a visual of what you're seeing here, this could be, and we should do this before anyone else does it, but we won't have time. Like, who are you in a business meeting? Because which country are you? Because I am Italy. She sits there. She's kind of got an RBF thing going on. But I love it because she is fierce and she is powerful from Italy. The NATO secretary, he's literally sitting in his chair with his right arm over the back of the chair, kind of just leaning comfortably in his chair. Meloni is sitting there and she looks like she's ticked, but she just gives the best facial expressions. They're never really like super joyful.
And she's always when the camera's not on her, or and you can still see her, she's not trying to put on some sort of
I love it
face. She's just kind of looking around like she looks bored sometimes. Is she thinking about something else?
I don't know if you can appreciate this the way I can appreciate it as a woman, but I think we've had these conversations before. Women in her position, you've heard me talk about people who would be like, Annie, smile. Has anyone ever come up to you, Ryan, and told you to smile?
Only the Prime Minister of Italy. Oddly.
And you did after she said so.
Well, she's had some authority.
There's this kind of thing, this expectation that women should just appear happy to others. Because a woman is more attractive if she's smiling, probably. Men are more attractive if they're smiling, probably. But there's pressure on women to look a certain way. And I think she gives zero fudge brownies about that.
Yeah, she doesn't.
And I respect her for it. Thank you for speaking and or just for not speaking and appearing for women around the world.
I don't think she's intentionally rolling her eyes, but she does kind of look like
that. She looks up at the ceiling.
Yeah. Yeah.
Over here, and then it goes over there. It's great. All right. We are going to monitor these talks. We're going to see if anything immediately comes out of this, and we will report back to you. I am very much so looking forward to see how much and how quickly progress happens here. My assessment is they all knew what they wanted to accomplish before they came here to do it. This is, in my opinion, what do I know? This is a publicized thing so that Putin can see it. You want to see a unified European Union in America? You want to continue to do this? We're going to offer you something. You're going to take it. Now, will it be successful? Let's wait and see. We'll be right back.
What's on your mind right now? The song you can't get out of your head? That breaking story? Or that conversation you just have to be a part of?
That's the brand new song from...
This is a breaking news report.
He shoots! He scores!
That's radio. Happening now. Connecting you to what matters most exactly when it's happening. From the airwaves to every device you stream on, radio is everywhere you are. It's local, live, and it's for you. Tag your favorite radio station tomorrow on social media and use hashtag National Radio Day to celebrate. That's hashtag National Radio Day.